Okay, we're beginning with the Mishnah in Ayin Aleph Amud Aleph. Mishnah begins, Ganav Mishel Aviv, if he stole material possessions from his father, Vachal Bishut Aviv, but then he consumed whatever it was in his father's possession, Mishel Acherim, or he stole from others, Vachal Bishut Acherim, and then he ate in other people's possession, Mishel Acherim, Vachal Bishut Aviv, or he stole from others, and then ate in his father's property, Ben Sorer Umore. He does not become a Ben Sorer Umore there. Ad, Shignov Mishel Aviv, and the theft is from his father, Veyuchal Bishut Acherim. But then he eats it somewhere else. So the reasoning behind this is what we've mentioned numerous times, is accessibility. We want the individual to have accessibility to the item, because then we are pretty certain that he'll continue down this path. In order to steal the theft that allows him to do this, if it's coming from his parents, that's something that's always available to him. If he's stealing from his father, then he's always has access to that, or he will have the ability to steal in that case. From others, it's much harder for him to steal. It's a concerted effort and a much bigger deal for him to steal from others. So we assume that if he's stealing from his father, then he'll get access to do that over and over again. The other issue is that we want him to be fearful of his father. If he's eating in his own father's property, that means he's not as afraid of his father at all. What we want is him to be stealing from his father, be afraid of his father, and therefore go and eat it somewhere else. Because all of those things contribute to the fact that he will continue down this path. If he doesn't have a fear of his father, then he's not going to hide the issue, and it's going to become publicly or well known. The question here is where he's stealing from his father and then taking it to other people's property. Only once he's stolen from his father and his mother. All right, so now the Gemara explicates on the Mishnah to address your question. Ganav Mishel Aviv, Vachal Bishut Aviv. But he steals from his father, and then he eats in his father's possession. Even though it's accessible to him, and he will have been able to do this over and over again, bite. He's still afraid of his father, and that's why he's too scared to take it somewhere else and eat it, because he continues to eat in his father's household. So that's an indication. It's almost counterintuitive, because you would have thought that if he was really afraid of his father, he would take off. The way the Gemara says it is that, and you can see this in Rashi, mitpached me'aviv shel yavin. He's afraid that his father will figure out, hilkach lo mamshich, therefore he won't continue down this path. The fact that he doesn't take it off to somewhere else is showing you that he's too scared to leave the father's house or for the father to find out about it. So he kind of does it in a way that doesn't seem like he's doing anything wrong. He continues to eat inside the household, maybe even along the lines of what you were suggesting before, that he, if he eats at home, he doesn't feel like he's really stealing it because he's still in his house. Mishel Acherim, Vachal Bishut Acherim, if he steals from others and eats in their possession, Afagav Delo Bait, even though he's not fearful because he's willing to leave the house, he's willing to go out and do things, Lo Shchiachle, that's not easily accessible, other people's property or possessions aren't available to him. V'chol Shekein, and certainly in the case Mishel Acherim, Vachal Bishut Aviv, he steals from others and then eats in his father's possession, it's not available to him on a regular basis, ubayit, and he's too scared not to eat by his father's house and not to eat at home. Ad, shignov mishel aviv, yochal bishut acherim. The only way that he becomes a ben sorer more is in a case where he steals from his father and then eats in other people's possession. Tishchiachlei, because there it's accessible to him, he will have availability of this, because he lives in the house, he'll be able to steal from his parents, below bait, and he's not afraid to walk away from the house, not afraid to go eat somewhere else, or do anything on his own. And therefore, this is where we worry about deterioration in the individual, because he's missing key elements. He's missing the element of fear of a parent. That's a big deal, because then there is no mitigating force against him. The other thing is that we have a facilitator, which is that the parent's money is available to him, and that will facilitate his ability to continue down this path. All right. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ad Shignov Mishel Aviv, Umishel Imo. Imo, Menala. How does his mother have independent possessions? Mashukanta Isha, Kanabala. Whatever a woman takes into her possession automatically goes into the possession of her husband. There is no independent ownership of the woman. Everything becomes assets of the estate, or in essence, assets of her husband. So how does she have independent ownership that he's stealing both from his father and his mother? So Amar Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, Misi'uda Muchenet Aviv Limo. It was a meal that was prepared for his mother and his father, and he stole the meal. As Rashi notes over here, there his mother does have a right or an ownership there because the father is obligated to provide mizonot for his wife. So if the meal is made and it's prepared for both the mother and the father, you have ownership technically of the mother and the father there. Wasn't the premise of Ben Sorer Moreh, based on what we saw yesterday, that the only way it happens is when he purchases cheap meat and eats it, cheap wine and drinks it? The only way they become a Ben Sorer Moreh is if you're doing it through a purchase, not through access to the actual meat and wine. Again, that has to do with availability. If his wine and meat is what he's searching after, and that's what he's stealing, it's not going to be so frequently available. It's not always going to be meat and wine hanging around the house that he can just grab and use. So money, which is available and will always be there, then if he's stealing that, then that's indicative of him being drawn into something that he will continue to do. He'll continue to steal money and then purchase the meat and the wine. So if he's doing it with money, then we worry. If he's doing it through the actual object itself, we don't worry because it's not going to be as accessible or easily available to him. He stole the money that was set aside for a meal for his mother and his father, and therefore he's stealing from both parties in that case. And that fulfills that necessity according to Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda. And on top of that, he now uses that money to purchase his basar and his yayin. Or another possibility is someone granted her possession of some object, and the condition of that granting of ownership was on condition that your husband has no rights here, meaning that he granted ownership or exclusive ownership to the woman in a way that her husband doesn't gain any ownership, and that leaves her with independent ownership, as the Balei Tosafot point out over here, sugya zuka Rav Sheshet. This sugya follows Rav Sheshet in the beginning of Kiddushin, that says that this works, this Tanai, according to the Rabbonon, works, and therefore you're able to block the husband's right of ownership in his wife's property. The Balei Tosafot offer that according to the dissenting opinion, according to Rabbi Elazar, where this doesn't work, nevertheless, you can explain our Mishnah in a case either the way that we did before, which is Dmei Suda, the monies that were set aside for a meal, because then mother and father do have ownership in it. Inami, Rabbi Elazar, Mukila B'Shinatan LaBala, her husband gave it to her and took away from his ownership. Or you can have it in a case where there's Nixay Malog that came to her and the husband forfeits ownership in the property, or he waives his right to the payrot and then goes into her possession. Or a case where she tells their husband, I'm not going to take Mizonot from you, but I'll keep my Masi Yadayim. So there's another instance where she can get independent ownership. And any one of those ways could explain the Mishnah, at least for Rabbi Elazar. Nevertheless, our Gemara uses this view of Rav Sheshet, that it could be in a case where someone else grants her ownership independent of her husband. Next Mishnah. Aya aviv rotzeh, b'imao eno rotzah. Her father wants to take him to court, but the mother does not. Aviv eno rotzeh, or the father does not want to take him to court, b'imao rotzah, and his mother does. Eno naseh ben sorero moreh. They both have to want it. They both have to be a party to bring him to court. If his mother is not appropriate for his father, then he doesn't become a ben sorero moreh. We see the problem in the marriage as contributing to the issue. So my ena ru'uya. What does it mean that the mother is not ru'uya for his father? If you want to say that they are problematic because this is an illicit relationship, v'chayve mitot beitin, or something even more severe, something that is subject to penalty by beitin, sof sof avua, avua ninu, v'imei, imei ninu. Why should that make a difference? In the end, his biological father is his father, and his biological mother is his mother. Even if he is a mamzer, and he's born of this illicit relationship, nevertheless, he has a father, he has a mother, they are his biological parents. If they bring them to court, then what's the issue? Ella b'shavida aviv kamar. He doesn't mean that there's a halachic problem. He says that she needs to be equal to his father. I mean that there has to be a parity between the mother and the father here. This is not a halachic issue, but a physical issue. Tanya nami ochi. Rabbi Yehuda omer, im lo hayta imo shavida aviv. If the mother is not equal to or parity with the father, bekol, the same voice, ubemare, the same appearance, ubekoma, and the same height, enu naseh ben sorer umore. then he can't become a ben zera omer. My time, Adam Akra, einenu shomeya bikolenu. It says that he does not listen to our voice. Midekol beinan shavin. Since by the voice we need it to be equal, because it uses the term kolenu. Now Rashi says over here, bikolenu chad kol mashmo. It sounds like one voice. Velo katuv bikolotenu o bikolenu biyud. Since it doesn't use the word kolenu here in the plural sense, it's nikol shelanu. So now that should have been either koloteinu, a kolot shelanu, two voices shelanu, or kolenu with a yud in it, which would have indicated again that there's a plurality. On the other hand here it says bikol shelanu, sounds like there's a single voice between the two of them. The other way you can have a single voice is if their voice is equal. Despite the fact that nowhere in the Torah does it spell it with a yud, nevertheless, over here, where you're speaking about two individuals, the Torah should have been more precise in using that plurality. In other places in the Torah, when you say kolenu, it's speaking about a large group of individuals speaking in a certain manner or directive, meaning that these individuals all together had the same thing to say. But that makes sense, then maybe there you can call it kolachat, or you can say it's one voice. There you say one voice means they're saying the same thing. But when you have two individuals, then at that point already, you should just say koloteinu or kolenu with the yud to say that they each are speaking. They might be saying the same thing, but still, there are two people speaking. The fact that it calls it kol, one voice, means that bin and shavin, we need them to be equal. And since by the kol we need them to be equal, marev koma nami bin and shavin. So too by their appearance, the way they look, and their height have to be the same. That's the view of Rabbi Yehuda. Kiman azla hadetanya. Who does this braita follow? Ben Sorer Mureh, lo haya, v'lo atid liyot. Never happened, and never will happen. V'lama nichtav, so then why was it written? Drosh v'kabel skar, in order that you are doresh, you learn the sugya, and you get skar for it. Kiman, who's that like? Ki Rabbi Yehuda, that's like the shita of Rabbi Yehuda we just saw here. The simple way to explain kolenu is to say that they're given the same message. They have the same problem with the child. And they're both coming and saying this child is doing exactly what. The parents are unified in their view about what the child is doing. That would be the simplest way to read it. Rashi claims that the lack of plurality in the word is indicative of there being more there. That it's not just that they're speaking in one voice, but they're physically speaking in one voice. That's what Rashi says. There are Tanaim who disagree. I mean, that's Rabbi Yehuda's view. Not all Tanaim agree with Rabbi Yehuda on that position. Now, if you look, the Aleph in Agota Bach indicates, why is it impossible to have such a circumstance? I mean, why is the Gemara so certain that the individuals here can't have the same voice, the same height, and the same appearance? They're dismissing the possibility of a ben sora omer because they think that this situation is not possible. So the Bach explains that, and he says, Nirvan, Aimishum Desfirle, Ditzrichim Liot Shavin Bekol, because they have to be equal in their voice. Imkein, Balkorch, Oshiesh la kol ki ish, vi ish, yesh lo kol ki isha. One of the two of them has a voice that is not appropriate for them. Either the woman sounds like a man, or the man sounds like a woman. Barizrich liot avivi mo shavin. Vim kein ohusaris, o ailonit, hi, de kol hu minasimanim. Vim kein irshar liot ben sorer umore. So the impossibility comes from the fact that the only reason that the woman would have a man's voice is because she's an Ilonit. The man would have a woman's voice because he's a Saris. That is an indication. The voice is an indication of that problem. So if they have an equal voice, that's indicative of one of the two of them having some problem. If that's the case, they wouldn't be able to bear children. And since they can't have children, that's what makes this Ben Sorer Umoret very unlikely category and almost near impossible. That's the view of the Bach over here as to why we equate between the impossibility of this case and that position of Rabbi Yehuda. Whereas the Gilyon HaShas, the Rabbi Akiva Eiger, points you to look in the Gemara in Yoma, because it's Minyana de Yoma. The Gemara in Yoma has the same requirement by the Shnei Seirim. By the two Seirim, they have to be equal. Equal price, equal height, equal appearance. So the Shnei Seirim that are bought, Echad Hashem, Echad Azazel, there the Gemara has that same requirement that they be of an equal nature. The problem is, if you're making such a demand like you're making here, how do you get the Shnei Seirim to be exactly equal? It seems from the Shnei Seirim that we wouldn't make such a high demand or threshold. So some indicate that by animals it's easier to do that. Human beings are much more distinct than animals. Although others suggest, I think the Sfat Emet over there suggests, that they have to be born as twins. You know, that you have to get twins that are Seirim in order that you have identical Seirim. In the end, it's not Ma'akev, every little detail, but you do see that there is a possibility of getting such a thing, which is not true by a mother and a father. Because the fact that they are a male and a female makes that it's not identical twins. So for that reason, you're not going to have that situation by human beings, which you could have by the animals. Because over there, the animals, we need Shnei Seirim, we need two males, so they can have identical twins. So that's how the Sfat Emet deals with that problem. But know that it is also an issue by the Shnei Seirim, because we are demanding similar requirements as to what we're requiring here by the Ben Sorer Umoreh. Ibaitema Rabbi Shimoni. Some suggest that the Ibrahim is authored by Rabbi Shimon. The Tanya, I'm Rabbi Shimon. Just because this guy ate a little meat and drank a bunch of wine, all of a sudden his parents take him out to be stoned. There's no such case. It never happened, it never will happen. And why was it documented? Drosh v'kabel schar. In order that you are doresh and you get schar for it. Amar Rabbi Yonatan, Rabbi Yonatan speaks up and says, Ani Ritif, I saw it, v'yashavti al kivro, and I sat on his grave, meaning that I was sitting on his grave, whether he's literally sitting on his grave or next to his grave, you're not allowed to sit on a grave, you're not allowed to get hanah from a grave. The point being that Rabbi Yonatan is saying that I was an eyewitness to a ben sorer umoreh. First of all, here you have numerous opinions. First of all, you have Rabbi Shimon, who doesn't believe fundamentally in this concept of the Ben Sorer Umoreh being punished al shem sofo, that he's going to be punished for what's going to happen in the end. That's what Rabbi Shimon asks. How could it be that this guy eats some meat, drinks some wine, and all of a sudden he's going to be stoned? That can't be the situation. Nobody's stoned for that. He didn't do anything that was so severe that he should be stoned for it. We saw already that the view of the Mishnah is, and the other Tanaim is, that he's niskal al shem sofo. He's killed on what we think will happen, what this will precipitate in the end. So Rabbi Shimon clearly doesn't believe that that is the right approach to take over here, and that you can't put someone to death for a crime of eating meat and drinking wine, even if you think that that will take place in the future. Rabbi Shimon solves the stira, or the problem, which is that we have a view in general when it comes to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the judgment then, as well as the story by Ishmael, which we read on Rosh Hashanah, but we say by Sher Husham, that God only judges the person where they are today, not based on their future acts or future problems that they will cause. And that's why Hashem says we're going to save Ishmael today, because he's deserving today, even though in the future he's going to cause lots of problems for Bnei Yisrael. So Sher Husham goes up against this problem of Ben Sorer Umoreh, where we are Nidon Hashem Sofo. So the Sifrei Chachamim asks about that stira. Really, the topic of the daf back on Samech Chet, or one simple way to deal with it is to say that in a case where a person is completely innocent, that we don't say Nidon Hashem Sofo. Over here, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. This person is already engaged in untoward behavior, so all we're doing is elevating the punishment that's associated with that behavior, not saying that this person didn't do an Avera, we're just going to kill them. They are subject to a penalty because of their behavior. What we're going to do is make that penalty higher so that he dies zakai and not chayav. And in that way, similar to the sota, who is not an innocent when she comes, there's circumstantial evidence indicating there was something wrong here, and that's why the treatment that we give her is very negative, because even if she is innocent, she's still engaged in behavior or circumstantial evidence that indicates that there was a problem over here. And similarly, by the Ben Sorer Umoreh, we have that activity already in hand. It's not like we're just punishing some innocent about their future. This is someone's already guilty, not guilty of a crime that resulted in a death penalty, but still guilty, and therefore punishing Malsim Sofo is not such a far-fetched thing. But Rabbi Shimon's position alleviates that problem, because Rabbi Shimon believes, you're right, you can't kill someone Malsim Sofo, and that's why he objects to the concept of stoning someone for eating meat and drinking wine, and that can't be the case, and it never will be the case. Then you have Rabbi Yonatan, who comes around and says, yes, I either saw a Ben Sorer Umoreh, or I sat on his grave. It's not clear from here whether he sat on a grave, he went to a grave and people told him that was a Ben Sorer or Moreh, or he actually witnessed the Ben Sorer being put to death by a Beitin. That leaves open a lot of interpretation here, because Rabbi Yonatan seems to have definitive evidence of the fact that there was a Ben Sorer or Moreh. So you could answer that he never saw it. Somebody told him that was the grave. You'll see that maybe from some of the upcoming statements as well. Somebody told him that's the grave of Ben Sorer or Moreh, not that he actually witnessed the Ben Sorer or Moreh. That's one possibility. The other possibility is brought up by the Chatam Sofer, who says that Rabbi Yonatan's statement was not that he saw a Ben Sorer or Moreh, but rather the words of the Chachamim were right. There was a Ben Sorer or Moreh who ate the basar and the yayin and did everything wrong, and they didn't put him to death because of what we see here in the Gemara. It's impossible to get him put to death. What happened in the end? He ended up being molested at the briot. He went down a down bad path, the path that the Chachamim describe over here. And he ended up being a marauder and got killed because of the activities that he got engaged with. Basically justifying what would have been to kill a Baal Shem Sofo. So again, even though we don't do it, it verifies that this is what's going to happen. That this is the outcome of such an individual. And you have to take extreme precaution, because the resultant Ben Sorer Moreh is what's going to come out. Even though we can't, as a court, enforce this or do this, the Torah is giving you information and saying, if this is what's happening now, there's a good chance that down the road, this is what's going to happen, and Rabbi Yonatan is confirming that. And that's how the Chatam Sofer solves the problem, saying that he was verifying or affirming the words of the Chachamim, not necessarily arguing on Rabbi Huda or Rabbi Shimon that there was never such a thing as a Ben Sorer or Moreh. Or the other way to explain what Rabbi Yonatan is saying is that, not literally that someone was a Ben Sorer or Moreh, but similar to what the Midrash Tanhuma brings, is that Avshalom, the son of David, was Negdark Ben Sorer Moreh. Not a halachic Ben Sorer Moreh, but a figurative Ben Sorer Moreh. And maybe that's what Rabbi Yonatan is either indicating, or how the other Tanaim will answer, how is it that Rabbi Yonatan sat on a grave of a Ben Sorer Moreh if it never happened, is because he's not literally it was a Ben Sorer Moreh. He was deemed a Ben Sorer Moreh, even though he didn't halachically fit that determination. Kamar Azla Adatanya, who does this braita follow? Yoni Dachat, Loita, Velo Atida Liyot. And Yoni Dachat never happened, and never will happen. Velama Nichtava, so then why is it included in the Torah? Drosh V'kabel Schar, that you should be Doresh and get Schar for learning it. Keman, who's that like? Ki Rabbi Eliezer. That follows the position of Rabbi Eliezer. The Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer, Omerikol, Ir, Sheish, Ba'afilu, Mezuzachat, Enen, Aseit, Ir, Anidachat. Any city that has even a single mezuzah in the city, then it can never be made into an Ir, Anidachat. By the way, many times, Jewish homes, and this is a way, many times to identify a Jewish home, even if the people are not religious, they usually have a mezuzah on the door, that's even in Chutz Laretz. So it's not a perfect. But even in people who are not religious in nature, nevertheless, they have a mezuzah on the door that's going to save the entire city. Why is that? My time on Makra, bet kol shlalatik botzel toch rechava, you have to take all the possessions, everything in the city, into the middle of the road, sarafta baish, and then burn it up. Became into ika mezuzah lo efshar, and if you have a mezuzah, that is not possible, dichtiv, lo tasun kein l'shem elokeichem. Because it says there's an instruction, we saw this earlier in the Masechta, that you should vibatem et shamam imakomo, you have to wipe out the name of Avodah Zarah from that place, and then immediately after that, the Pasuk says, lo tasen kein l'shem elokeichem. Don't do the same to God. Now, over there, when we discussed it, the Pasuk can go either direction. The Pasuk can be read with that which is before, or that which is after in the Parshia. Two topics that are there. One topic is, they are makriv, they're korbanot everywhere. You can't do that. You can only bring your korbanot in the Mikdash. Or the other possibility is what we're reading it as now, which is the instruction there. Wipe out all of Avodah Zarah. You may not do that to Hashem. I mean, that's why you're not allowed to erase the Shem Hashem. You're not allowed to destroy the Shem Hashem. And destroying a mezuzah would be covered by this. This does raise a serious issue in many of the achronim, as to why the Gemara doesn't say here, asay doche lo tasay. In general, we have a principle. When you have a positive commandment and a negative commandment, when they come into confrontation, when they are clashing, we say that the asay is doche lo tasay. But here you have an essay to burn all the possessions of the Eir Nidachat, and you have a lot essay of lot essay in Kain, Hashem Elokeichem. You're not allowed to erase the name of Hashem. So the essay of Eir Nidachat should override the lot essay of lot essay in Kain, Hashem Elokeichem. So the Achronim try to discuss why that may not be the case here, including suggesting that it's not only a lot essay, maybe there's an essay as well that's associated with it, not just a restriction against erasing the name of Hashem, but a positive commandment that you must treat the Shem Hashem with reverence. So that's one way to get over the problem, because then you're not an asei docha lo tasei, you're asei docha asei v'lo tasei, it doesn't work. Or other suggestions are, it's lo be'idanei, it's not simultaneous, meaning that the only way an asei is docha lo tasei is when the asei is done at the same time you violate the lo tasei. Over here, you'll set fire to the mezuzah before you accomplish the burning of all the possessions of the Yer HaNidachat. So the assay happens after the Lot Assay is violated. Although many reject that answer because of the fact that once you engage in doing the assay, it's as if you're doing the assay. You don't have to do exactly that moment the assay itself. As long as you're on the path doing the assay, that's called engaged in the assay. So here where you're starting to burn it, that's already accomplishing the mitzvah of the assay. So that's not a reason to disqualify it. But maybe others suggest that this is such a severe lav, meaning denigrating or desecrating the Shem Hashem is such a severe restriction that it won't allow for an assay to be docha it, even though, again, we find in other places that we do have assay docha lot assay in these types of situations. Again, the Achronim are speculating as to how to get out of the problem of a say docha lo tasei here, that is noted. Rashi later on in Kuf Yud Gimel and Aleph says the reason for this is because the only requirement is to burn Chefzei Adam and not Chefzei Shamayim. Although that really creates a bigger problem, because if this isn't subject to being burnt, then why does it protect the rest of the shalal of the city? And Rabbi Kiv Ego over there already questions Rashi's explanation based on that. Although what you'll have to say is something along the lines of what we indicated before, which is that means that the lav of burning a mezuzah is not overridden by the mitzvah of burning the possessions of a Eir HaNidachat. Not that the mezuzah is completely exempt, just means that the mezuzah cannot be subjected to the assay there, and that's why it protects the other possessions. I'm Rabbi Yonatan. Once again, Rabbi Yonatan says, Aniri Tia, Vishavti Al Tila. I saw such a city, and I sat on the tell, I sat on the mound that was the resultant of this destroyed city. Here, you can't really use the answer of the Chatam Sofer. You could argue, I guess, again here, that this was the end of the city. Even though they couldn't destroy the city was ended up being destroyed because it was an Eir HaNidachat. K'man Azad Tanya, who does this bright to follow? Beit HaMinuga lo haya lo atid liyot. That a house that has Tzorat never happened and never will happen. V'lama nichtav, again, why was it written? Drosh v'kabel schar. Again, so that you are doresh and you get schar for it. K'man, k'belaze b'Rabbi Shimon. That follows the position of Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Shimon. The Tanan, we have a Mishnah in Nigaim. There are three opinions as to what is the requirement of the size of the nega in a house in order for it to be tameh. Everybody agrees that you need a nega that is twice the size of a normal nega. A normal nega tzarat is k'gris, al gris. It is a square gris. A grease is a bean. It's the size of a pole. So now, normally, tzarata adam, tzarata or, tzarata beged, you need a grease al grease. Because of the way that psukim lay out by nige batim, over there you need two greasim. You need a 2x1 strip, you need it to be 2 greased by 1 grease so that you have 2 1x1s. There's a three-way machloket as to where it has to appear. Is the opinion of Rabbi Shmuel who believes that it can appear on 1 stone in the house or 2 stones in the house. It doesn't matter. Then you have the position of Rabbi Akiva who says that it has to appear on 2 stones, but those 2 stones could be even on the same wall. Then you have the third opinion, which is Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon Omer, Olam in a bayit amei, ad shirek ishtei grisim al shtei amanim. That's similar to the opinion that we just saw, that you need the 2 grisim to be on 2 stones, the shtei kotlim, on 2 walls, Bekeren Zavit. And obviously the only where that can be is if it's in a corner. Because in a corner it'll be on 2 stones, as well as on 2 walls. Arko Kishne Grisim, the length is like 2 grisim. Verachbo, and its height is that of a gris. My time with the Rabbi Shimon. Why does he require it to be on 2 walls? which is what he says different than the previous opinion. K'tiv kir, u'k'tiv kirot. By the psukim in Negev Batim, it uses the term kir, and it uses the term kirot. So the only way to resolve between it being one wall and two walls is ukir shu kirot. What is a wall that is like two walls? Avi Omer is a keren zavit, that is the corner. So he has the highest threshold, which is it has to be a 2x1 kigris, or at least a 2x1 kigris, on two stones in the corner of the house, on two walls. So that's a very high threshold. That high threshold makes it that it's nearly impossible. Now, as opposed to the other cases here, where the probabilities made it that it's almost or nearly impossible, like we saw by the Ben Sorer Umoreh, either because Rabbi Shimon says you can't kill someone al atid or shema sofo, Rabbi Yehuda because you need the parents to be exactly equal, which is a near impossibility, if not impossible. But here in Idachar also, we saw that the mezuzah saves the city, nearly impossible, if not impossible, you're not going to have a city that has one mezuzah or has one Sefer Kodesh in it that would need to be burnt, and that would stop the Yeren Idachat. Over here, it's a difficulty, but not impossible. It makes it much rarer, but not completely impossible. Nobody says anything here that it's still plausible, just improbable. That's what it seems like from Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon. Nevertheless, the Gemara scribes the statement in the Braita of the fact that it would never did happen, never will happen to his position because of that improbability. Now, let's just finish up the Gemara and then we'll say a couple words about this. Tanya, I'm Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Tzadok. Mekama haya b'tchum Aza. There was this area around Aza. V'yukorin ota churvas kirata. It was a destroyed tzarat. So whether that means this was a house of tzarat, of Mitzora, that was destroyed and it had that name or the name stuck with it, or whether this was an area where they put the stones from a house that had tzarat. Either way, it's indicative of the fact that tzarat did happen, or tzarat the Batim did happen. I'm Rabbi Shimon, Ish Kvarako, Pamachar Alakti the Galil. One time I went up north, Vreiti Makom Shemitzainin Oto, I saw a place that they put white on it. This is known from the Mishnayot, that they used to whiten or put white plaster over areas that had tuma in them. Whether it was tumat amet or safek tuma, tuma where the kohanim or okhlei chulin b'tara would avoid, because if you went there, it's possible that you become tame. So after the rainy season, one of the things they did in Adar, after the rainy season when they got the shkalim, this beitim went out and made sure that they demarcated all the kvarot. They went out and put whitewash on them so people would know not to walk there when they're coming up for the regel, when they don't want to be tameh, the kohanim, when they eat the tuma. So they used to, every year, whitewash them again to make sure people knew where the tuma was. So over here, we have such a nice thing. There's a demarcation up in the Galil of white. And I asked, what is that? Why are they marking that off as being tameh? Didn't look like a kever, looked like a bunch of stones. This was a dump for stones that were taken out of a house that had negaim in it. That's one of the requirements. If you find the tumat negaim in the house, you have to take out the stones. You have to scrape them out of the house, take them out and replace those stones. The stones that are taken out are then dumped michutz the ear outside of the city. So here was the dump where they put these avanim and ugot, but negaim are mitame kemet. They have a din like a mate, and therefore they're mitame bohel. So you didn't want someone to walk over these stones, because if they did, they become tamei like tumatameit, and that'd be problematic. So they marked them or demarcated them the equivalent to a grave, because they have the same features as a grave. So both of these statements would indicate that there was, at some point, nigei batim. The fact that we have more evidence in this situation that there were nigei batim accords with what I said before, which is that by the case of the Ben Sorer Morer and the Anadachat, it seemed nearly impossible. Over here, the case of relationship Ben Shivon says that it's improbable, but not necessarily impossible. And over here, you see that we have evidence from others suggesting that it was the case. In neither case did they say that they saw it. In both cases, it was hearsay evidence where people were telling that this is the name of this, or this is why this is. That means that it wasn't absolute proof, but rather it was hearsay that through others, or through the grapevine, they had now information about the fact that there might have been Negei Batim. The other thing is that you have to reconcile this with the Midrash that says that Hashem made the Negei Batim for the benefit of Bnei Israel. It was the Tovatam, that when they entered into Eretz Yisrael, that the residents of Eretz Yisrael were hiding matmoniot in the walls and the houses, and there's no way that the Israelim would ever find them. So Hashem caused the Nigei Batim to come so they'd have to knock out the stones or the walls, and then they would find all the hidden wealth that was kept in the walls of the house. So that would indicate that it was something positive. And so then what you might have to do is bifurcate the din and say, yes, Nigei Batim took place in those situations where it was helpful or positive. Doesn't take place in a case where it's for a punishment or something that is negative. That might be another split that you want to make in order then to answer the question about that midrash, as well as to answer what's going on here in the Gemara. Why there are people saying there were Nigei Batim? Maybe those were ancient Nigei Batim from the time when they entered into Eretz Yisrael versus Nigei Batim in their time, which they're saying never took place or never happened and never will take place. Again, the last possibility is that there are machlokot here. That is machloket midrashim, machloket bin tanaim, and that's also a plausible explanation. Now, why would you have this? I mean, this idea of drosh mekabel schar, that you should learn the parsha and get schar, seems so esoteric. Seems like, why would you do that? Why would you need that? Why would the Torah write that? So there are a number of things to say from this. Number one is that there is a requirement of limud Torah, even though it doesn't lead to anything practical, possibly, which is that there is a mitzvah of limud Torah, qua limud Torah, to learn Torah, period. That's what's being suggested here. These have no practical ramifications, yet you're supposed to learn them. So that teaches you that limud Torah itself has value, independent of the practical ramifications. That's one thing you could conclude, but I think you could argue in the opposite direction is that they do have meaning, they just don't have practical ramifications, but they have practical ramifications, meaning doing exactly what's said here, but they do have hashkafic ramifications. They have ramifications in the way that the Torah is pointing you or teaching you about certain topics. And that might be what the purpose of learning this is. Maybe you won't get a halachic outcome in the sense was what to act and to perform a specific quantitative mitzvah, but you will get qualitative instruction from this, and then maybe that's the value of limud Torah here. So then maybe that previous statement that I made is not true, and there is value to it. The value would be to indicate what the Torah thinks about certain things. Number one, the importance of chinuch. The chinuch of the children is supremely important, and making sure that a child doesn't go off the derech, or a child doesn't get lost because they get caught up in these problematic issues, is of paramount importance, both in the way of the parents towards the child, but as well as the community's involvement with the child in preventing children from ending up in these situations. And that's indicated through the Ben Sorer Moreh, which is both an indictment that the parents need to be involved with them, as well as the courts have to get involved in order to stop this type of deterioration. I think this was brought to the forefront very recently with the story that was told over about a young girl who passed away recently after being rejected by a number of schools and getting involved with the wrong crowd and then in drugs and so on and so forth. And now the father came forward and spoke about it in some more insular communities where people don't speak about it. And he spoke about it and there was an article about it. It's a heart-wrenching article. But this is really almost the story of the Ben Sorer HaMoreh, in that here somebody went off the derech. They were pushed off because of the communal pressures that didn't allow that person to be part of the community. But so on and so forth. We need to be attuned to that, and we need to deal with it. So that's something maybe taught by Ben Sorer HaMoreh. The Rabbeinu Bechaya actually has an interesting interpretation of Drosh Mekabel Schar with regards to Ben Sorer HaMoreh, where he says, it comes to teach us the tremendous Avat Hashem that is required of an individual. Similar to Avram Avinu by the Akedah, where Hashem demanded an Avat Hashem, which meant even giving up his child, so too the instructions of the Ben Sorer HaMoreh. Parents' love for a child is unparalleled. Despite that fact, the Torah requires that the parents give up the child out of Avat Hashem because of the wayward path that this child is taking. And so what the Rabbeinu Bechaya says is that the Drosh Mekabel Schar is teaching you to what extent is Avat Hashem. Not that it happened or ever happened, but to teach you how much is expected of you in return in regards to Avat Hashem. And the Eliyahu Kitov actually has a cute way to explain it, which is, Drosh Mekabel Schar, since they engaged in this parsha and they learned this parsha, it will never happen because now they're aware of it. They'll prevent it from happening. They'll act in a way that won't allow it to happen. So the reason it doesn't happen is because they learned the parsha and it's self-fulfilling in that way. Erni Dacha teaches you the perniciousness of Avodah Zarah, the dangers of Avodah Zarah, the dangers of people Like maybe false messiah is coming and convincing people to do things. You see here that individuals could cause a whole city to leave the path of Torah or to go off and worship Avodah Zarah. You have to worry about these charismatic messiahs that come around and mislead people, or even the problems that are associated with the Avodah Zarah. That's indicated to this. By the case of Tzarat HaBatim, also we know that comes about from either miserliness, or from Lashon Hara, from other issues that come up, or the importance of Kedushat HaBayit. The house is a mini Beit HaMikdash. Tzarat HaBayit is indicative of that failure, that the Kedushat HaBayit has been lost somehow, and that's why there's Tumah that is permeating over there. So even if you say it didn't happen, there is something to be learned from each of these items. I do think that that has even greater ramifications. I'm not going to speak in detail about it, I'll just mention it, and it's food for thought, which is that many of the mitzvot that are mentioned in Sefer Dvarim, all of these are included, except for Tzarat, but the case of Irni Dachat, and the case of Ben Sura Omer, which seem to be very severe capital punishments for certain situations. And we have that by other issues throughout Sefer Dvarim, which today, when you have Muslim groups like ISIS and the Taliban running around and actually performing these executions, and if you listen to what they do, they're doing exactly what is prescribed by the Torah. And so then, how are we looking at this? We are offended by it. We feel like it's totally misguided. Yet the Torah does instruct us to do the exact same thing that they are doing or they're carrying out. This tells you that many times when the Torah is speaking, it's not necessarily speaking that this will come to fruition. That we'll see in the Gemara in Makot already, where a Beit Din that kills 1 in 70 years is considered to be a killer Beit Din. The oral tradition, the oral law, comes to define and interpret the Torah Shebichtav in such a way or such a manner that it sets up a structure by which almost never will the punishments that are noted in Sefer Dvarim come to fruition. In addition, the thresholds of evidence are very high. It's not that somebody came and told or somebody decided that we have to put this person to death, which is a feature of the ISIS and the Taliban. But rather, you have to have a court, you have to have full protocols, you have to have real witnesses, you have to have a real adjudication that takes place in order to bring someone to capital punishment, and the thresholds are extremely high, thresholds of evidence are very high, to the point where it's almost impossible. The fact that they're killing people one after the next is indicative of them not having those thresholds. But the Torah Shebaal Peh, in some ways, I would say softens the Torah Shebichtav, but in many ways talks about this, Drosh V'Kabel Schar. Which is that, if that's the case, then why does the Torah Shebichtav tell you all these dinim if the Torah Shebaal Peh is going to come in the end and reverse it or say it's never going to happen? The answer is, the Torah is trying to teach you something about the severity of crimes, the problems that arise in these situations. I'll give one example, which is at odds with Western thought. Which is that in Western thought, if two people have an extramarital affair, that's their free choice. Everybody's free to do what they want. That's not something that we would punish for. On the other hand, when it comes to rape in Western thought, rape is considered to be a terrible, terrible sin. If you look in the Torah looks at it in the opposite way. I'm not saying that the Torah condones rape. The Torah thinks of rape in the same way that Western thought thinks of it. It thinks it's disastrous. It uses the punishment in order to try to stop the person before they engage in that activity, because they say it's not a one-time thing. It's not just going to be this and out. It's going to be you're going to be stuck with this woman the rest of your life. So now, the other way around, when they look at an extramarital affair, the fact that the Torah thinks of that as being a death penalty tells you they don't think like Western thought, which is that, oh, whatever you want to do, it's your choice. Consulting adults can do whatever they want. No, the Torah tells you that there's a kedusha associated with marriage. There's a kedusha associated with the union of a man and a woman, so much so that the abrogating of those vows, that connection between a man and a woman, is a very serious offense. And it shows that through the death penalty. So in that way, the Torah is opining on what it thinks of these situations and how it thinks differently than Western thought today. Anyway, just giving you something to think about in terms of why you would have these things, Drosh V'Kabel Schar, because I think it has value, and a lot of value, and it helps to us to distinguish ourselves from more crude implementations of this, like the Taliban and the ISIS, but also gives us food for thought about these issues and about where they sit in the hierarchy of morals and ethics that the Torah is trying to propose to us. All right, next Mishnah. If one of the parents is missing a limb, an arm or a leg, or they're unable to speak, they're mute, O suma, they're blind. O cheresh, they're unable to hear. Inu aseh ben surer o moreh. All of these preclude the ability to have a ben surer o moreh. Shneimar, because the pasuk says, v'tafsu bo aviv v'imo, that they have to grab a hold of him and bring him to Beit Din. V'lo gidmin, if they're missing an arm, then they can't grab a hold of him. V'otzio oto, they have to take him out to the Beit Din. V'lo chingrin, that means they can't be missing their leg. V'amru, they say, v'lo yilmin, and they're not mute. B'neinu zeh, or this child, v'lo sumim, they're able to point to the child, they're able to indicate who the child is, so not sumim. Einenu shomea bikolenu, he doesn't listen to what we say, v'lo cherishin, and not them being deaf. That is because when they tell the child not to do it, they can't hear what his response is. How do they know einenu shomea bikolenu? How do they know that he's not listening to what they're saying? Maybe he agreed to it, or maybe he acquiesced, or maybe he dissented. We don't know because they are deaf. Now, his actions obviously indicate whether he's listening or not, but that's not enough. It's enu shomea bikolenu, specifically about what we're saying he's not accepting. And there we don't know because they are deaf. Whether the Gemara over here is just saying this is a technicality, which we'll see in a second, the Gemara is going to say the pasuk is all extraneous, and therefore we learn something from this, and it's just gzeirat ha-ketuv, or the Torah sees a problem, which is that the ben surer o moreh is a product both of his genes as well as his environment. And the question is, how much of his environment is causing the problem versus what is he responsible for? And a problem with a parent could be the precipitating factor for the child. The child may be reacting to the difficulty of a parent with whatever deficit they have. Now, obviously, people can overcome these deficits, but it still may have an impact on the child because of that disability. Today, obviously, it's much easier to deal with that versus in their day where those disabilities were real disabilities to the point where you were shunned from society. For a child born into a family like that or a parent having a parent like that, that could have been something that was traumatic to the point that you end up with a ben surer o moreh. I think it's still difficult today. I think it was infinitely more difficult in their time because they were not accepted in society in those days. So I'm saying you could suggest that it's not just the gzeirat ha-ketuv, but the Torah sees in that contributing factor, and therefore you can't blame it all on the child's behavior here. So that's a suggestion. I'm not saying that that's meant here, but it's not clear whether this is just the gzeirat ha-ketuv or they see some sort of contributing factor from the parents in this way. Machin bo b'fnei shlosha umalkin oto. You warn him in front of three, and then they give him malkot. Chazar v'kilkel. If he then goes back and causes the problem again, does it again, nidon b'esrim shlosha. Then we upgrade to a Beit Din of 23. V'enu niskala sheisham shlosha rishonim. And the only way that they can put him to death in the second violation is if the judges from the first incident, the first three judges are also present. Shenemar b'neinu zeh, zehu shalaka b'fneichem. Because when the parents come and present the child, they say, this is the child that got malkut here by you, by your hands. So meaning that they are indicating that the judges who were the original judges are also part of this new Beit Din. We'll see in a second the limud, but it's not clear here what exactly went on or what the procedure is. There is a machloket rishonim in that manner. Shma mina, be'inan krakid ichtiv. From this you would conclude that we take psukim literally. So now you can see this Gemara is cross-referenced earlier in the Masechta Dav Kandaf Mamhei Amud Bet. That's where Shmuel makes the statement that if the one of the Eidim is missing an arm, that we can't put the person to death. Because it says, Yad Eidim Te'abo B'Rishona. And Shmuel says, if he doesn't have an arm, we can't do that. And then the Gemara goes on to discuss whether we take psukim literally. This was one of the pieces of evidence that we take psukim literally. Here we're taking the pasuk very literally. Shani Ocha, the Gemara says, over here, the Kulei Kray Yitei Rehu. Over here, you can't say that that is the reason, because here, the entire Pasuk is extraneous, as Rashi notes over here, because it, Matzi the Mikhtav, it could have just said, Otzeitem Oto Sharair, Ha'o Skaltem. You could have just written in a summary form, take him out to the gated city and stone him. What is all this extraneous language of the Tafsu Oto, that they grab a hold of him, and then they bring him to the Beit Din? There's a lot of extra verbs in the Pasuk that are unnecessary to convey the message of what needs to happen, and therefore it's considered to be extraneous, and that's why we take it literally, not that we would take all Psukim literally. Matrin b'fnei shlosha. We warn him in front of three. Lamali. Why do I need three? Betray Sagya. You just need two Eidim. You need to eat him that the parents gave him a warning. You don't need to do this in front of three. So Rabbi Yachikamar, Matrim bo b'fnei shnayim, umalkin oto b'fnei shlosha. You're right. The warning takes place before two, And then you give him malkot in front of three. Then you have a requirement of a beit din. You need for corporal punishment, you need a beit din, that is three judges. So the hatra'ah takes place b'fnei shnayim, and the halakha takes place before shlosha, before three. Now, over here, the question is raised by many of the Rishonim, as well as Rashi over here, which is, how is this hatra'ah different than the normal hatra'ah? Anybody who's put to death requires a warning. I mean, you need hatra'ah before you put anybody or give anybody a death penalty. So why is this different? If you're going to put the Ben Sarer Moreh to death, he needs hatra'ah. So when you say matrino to, you warn him, how is this warning differentiated from the normal hatra'ah that is required? So Rashi on the Mishnah says, La mishum hatra'ah gmura kashar averot. This is different than the hatra'ah that's found by other sins. Shein lokin ela b'hatra'ah, because you only normally get malkot with hatra'ah. Da hatra'ah edim boi. Because hatra'at edim, here you need hatra'at edim. Ba'od, zosefek hatra'ahu. Over here, it is a hatra'ah that is a safek. Here, the warning, number one, is given by the parents, not by the witnesses. Number two is, the parents are warning him not to do something. Then he goes and engages in it. So the hatra'ah is not a warning where he's about to engage in an activity, and they're saying, don't do this. And then the person says, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway, which means that the hatra'ah is directed at the action he's about to take. Here the hatra'ah is literally a warning, saying, don't get engaged in this. And the violation only happens if he does get engaged in it. But we don't know if that's going to happen. That's what's called hatra'at safek. So Rashi says, Ela mochichin oto, that we chastise him. Debinim v'yisruel oto shlo yargil. The parents have to chastise him and indicate to him that this is not acceptable behavior, and if he continues down this path, we're going to take him to Beit Din, and he's going to get malkot. Gimlo shama, if he doesn't listen, malkino to be Beit Din. Then they give him lashes in Beit Din, v'yalitzlam im yisru oto. And we learn that out from v'yisru oto, which we're going to see in the Gemara in 1 second. So here, according to Rashi, there are actually three stages in this process. The child goes out and does something wrong. He steals, Tarjimar Basar and Yayin, and he acts like a Ben Sarer Moreh. Then the parents come in and warn him that he may not continue or he may not engage in this activity again. If he violates that warning of the parents, then he's taken to Beit Din and he's given lashes. Then if he violates it a third time, meaning that he steals a third time and does it even after he's gotten the lashes, then he's subject to a death penalty. So according to Rashi, in order to end up in a death penalty, you actually have to steal and act this way three times. So that's interesting in and of itself, because that means that we won't put him to death until, in essence, we have a chazaka that he is continuing to act this way. He's done it three times. That's despite dissuasion from engaging in this activity. He did it the first time. We can excuse it. We already warned him at that point. The parents said, don't do it, and engage in it again. Okay, let's say he didn't really understand, or he wasn't really sure that his parents were serious. So then we give him malkot. We're serious about this. And we warn him, if he engages again, he's going to have a death penalty. And then he does it again. Then it's clear already that he's reached a point where he's not going to desist from this behavior on his own. He's basically addicted, or he's going down a really bad path. And that's when we put him to death. That would be the explanation according to Rashi. And in that way, Rashi differentiates the hatra'ah here in the Mishnah, which is not a warning that we normally find by the death penalty. You have to have that here as well in order to get malkot and in order to get the death penalty. It's a separate type of hatra'ah, which is the parents, after the first time he engages in activity, warning him not to do it again. And that's the hatra'ah that we're speaking about here. That's Rashi's view. And the fact that the Ben Sarer Moreh is Nidon Oshim Sofo might actually explain part of why we need so much of this process to happen. Because we're not punishing him for what he's doing now, we're punishing him based on what we think will happen. Therefore, we need to establish a recurring type of behavior, and that's why we need these warnings, or these v'yisruel to, that we don't normally have by other averot. If you look in the Rambam, the Perish of Mishnayot, the Rambam in the Perish of Mishnayot does not have three stages, he only has two stages, and it seems that the Rambam thinks that the hatra'ah here is no different than the hatra'ah that we would normally find in other cases. And simply, you warn him not to engage in activity. If he violates that warning, he gets malkot. And then if he violates again that dissuasion from engaging in his activity, then he will get skila. For the Rambam, there's only two stages. For Rashi, there are actually three stages over here. He has to do it three times. He has to be a three-peat offender in order to get the death penalty. For the Rambam, he only has to do it twice in order to end up with the death penalty. Mari asked the question, Malkot ben Sarer Moreh, Chaktiva. Where do you ever see that there are malkot by the Ben Sorero Moreh? So Gemara says, Kidderabi Abau, Damarabi Abau, Lamadnu. So Rabbi Abau's din has nothing to do with Ben Sorero Moreh, actually has to do with Motzi Shemra. In the case of Motzi Shemra, how do we know that the individual who lied or tried to cast aspersions on his newly wed wife, that she had an extramarital affair before they got married, and he's found to be lying over there, how do we know that he gets malkot? So that's actually what Rabbi Abau is after, and he says there, Lamadnu Bayisru. Over there it says that the court, well, Bayisru at the Baal, who lied and did the wrong thing. What is the meaning of Bayisru over there? So there he says, we learn Bayisru, Bayisru. We have Bayisru told by Ben Sorero Moreh. We have Bayisru by Motzi Shemra that teaches you that what is true by Ben Sorero Moreh is also true by Motzi Shemra. Then, Bayisru mi Ben. And then Bayisru by the Ben Sorero Moreh, we learn from the word Ben, which is used there, because it says, Ki Eliish Ben Sorero Moreh, and Enu Shomeh B'Kol Aviv B'Kol Imo, V'Yisru Oto V'Yishma Lehem. So you have the word Ben, and you have the word V'Yisru that are found there together. So then, you take the word Ben, and we learn Ben Mi Bin. And then that Ben, we learn out from Bin, which is also later on in that same Parshat Kitetze, which is V'Yah Im Bin Hakol Tarasha. So you have here a double Gzeres Shavah. We have V'Yisru and V'Yisru, which teaches you that what's true by Ben Sorero Moreh is also true by Motzi Shemra. We have Ben and Yisru that are found both in the same Pasuk in Ben Sorero Moreh. And then that Ben that is in Ben Sorero Moreh, we connect to Vaya Imbin Hakot Arasha to teach you that they're in Balkot or Vayisru Oto by Ben Sorero Moreh means Balkot. And then we take that over but through the Vayisru to the Motzi Shemra where it says, Balkhuzik Ne'ayariya Ta'ish Vayisru Oto. If he's found to be lying, Vayisru Oto, and that Vayisru Oto matches up with the Vayisru of the Ben Sorero Moreh, Banshu Oto Me'akesef, to teach you that not only does he have to pay a fine there, but he also gets Malkot for his misdemeanor. And even though we mentioned earlier that the Azara for Ben Sorero Moreh comes from Lo Tochlu Al Adam, that is for the Mitat Beitin, but in order to give him Malkot, that was a Lavsh B'Klalot that won't allow us to give him Malkot. So Vayisru Oto is a separate lav or limu that teaches us that there is malkot over here, despite the fact that the azhara for the mita comes from lo tochlu al adam. Right now the Gemara says, chazar v'kilkel nidon b'chav gimel. If he then has a subsequent violation, he's brought to a court with 23, which is where his capital punishment will be adjudicated. Haimi ba'ilei ze velo sumin. How can you use the word zeh to teach you that this is the same child that we brought before you from Malkot, when we already use the word zeh to teach you b'neinu zeh means that they can't be blind? It says, im kein lechtog kra b'neinu hu. They should have just said, this is our child. My b'neinu zeh. So then, what does it mean b'neinu zeh? Shma minatarte. From that, you can learn both things out. B'neinu hu would teach you that it's the same child that you gave Malko to. This is the same child before. Zeh, always in the words of Chazal, Hazeh Zeh, always indicates the physical pointing towards. That means that they can't be sumim, they can't identify him. Next Mishnah. Barach Achlog Mardino. He ran away before they were able to come to a verdict. Barachakach Hikif Zakanat Ketachton. Then afterwards, he becomes fully covered in pubic hair. Patur. Then he is Patur. He's graduated out of being a Ben Sorero Moreh. He's out of age. He's outgrown it. He is aged out of being a Ben Sorero Moreh. And since we didn't bring a verdict before he aged out, then there is no bringing him back. On the other hand, if the Gmar Din or the verdict was already done when he was in the age of Ben Sorero Moreh, and then he ran away, and then he aged out, chayav. There we still execute him because the verdict was reached when he was still a Ben Sorero Moreh. Just because he ran away doesn't mean we're not going to punish him later on when he gets older. Amar Rabbi Chanina, Ben Noach should birech et Hashem. If you have a Ben Noach who violates one of the Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach, which is Birkat Hashem, v'achar kach nitgayer, and then he converts after this violation, patur, there he can't be put to death. Because over there, his din has changed, as well as his death penalty. The death penalty for violating the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach is Saif. There is the Tanit of B'nai Menashe who says it's Chenek, but it's a standard death penalty. For a Jew, Birkat Hashem is subject to Skila. Totally different punishment. Much higher punishment by a Jew. Number one. Number two is Nishtana Dino, which is now he is a Jew and he's no longer a Goy. So he's now changed in terms of his status from being a non-Jew to a Jew, which is Ketinok Shenolad Dami, and his punishment would change as well. That's enough change that we no longer put him to death for the violation while he was a Goy. Name him Isayile. Let us say our Mishnah supports this position of Rabbi Hanina. Barach Hachalo Nigmar Dino. He ran away before the Gemar Din. And then he ages out because he now has full pubic hair. Patur. Then he doesn't get brought to trial. My time up. La Mishum Darminin Ovi Ishtane Ishtane. Since he already grew up, he changed. His body has changed. He's now a new person. He's aged out. Therefore, since he aged out, we don't give him the punishment that would have been ro'oi had he been younger. Where says, lo, shani ocha di avad hashta lav bar katalu. The difference by the ben sorer moreh is that if he did this violation now, he would not be culpable. He would not be brought to death. And that's why he's patur when we find him dead. But that may not be the case by the goy that converted, because if he did it again now, he would be chayav as a Yisrael. So maybe over there it's not considered to be a significant enough change that we consider it as if he's a new person. Tashma, let's look at the sefer of our Mishnah. Imish Mgnar Nino Barach, if he ran away after the Gemar Din, Vachakach he keeps Gana Takton, then afterwards he aged out, Chayav, he's still Chayav. So there you see, or it seems to be a disproof to Rabbi Hanina, that over here, even though he aged out, we still give him the same punishment that he would have gotten when he was younger. It says, Nigmar Dino Kamart? You're saying that the verdict was already rendered? Mgnar Dino Gavra Katilo. Once the verdict is rendered, he's a walking dead person. He was deserving the death penalty. So that fact that we find him later doesn't mean he wasn't subject to the death penalty at the time when he was the proper age. Since the verdict was determined when he was the proper age, it sticks with him even if he gets older. So that's different than the case here where Rabbi Hanina says he did the violation, but he wasn't brought to trial. There was no verdict before he converted. So Tashma, Ben Noach shikat chaveiro. Ben Noach who hits his friend over here, it's a fatal blow. He kills his friend. Baal Eshet Chaveiro, or he has an affair with his friend's wife, Venitgayer, and then he converts, Patur. Asakein b'Yisrael, Venitgayer Chayav. If he did this to a Jew, and then converted, he'd be Chayav. V'amai, Nemo, Holy Ishtani, Ishtani, why don't you invoke Rabbi Hanina's principle, that since he converted, his din has changed, and since his din has changed, therefore he should not be subject to the same penalties he had before. But it says, Dino umitato beinan. We needed that the same verdict would be rendered, as well as the same punishment would be rendered, then it's considered as if he's the same person. If it's differentiated, then he's a different person. So here, v'hai dino ishtane, over here, his din changed, mitato lo ishtane. On the other hand, his death penalty did not change. So even though his din has changed now, which is now he's subject to the rules and protocols of a Jew, which means that he needs edim, hatra'ah, edah. He needs a full beit din of 23. He needs two edim. He needs a warning. None of which are needed by a ben Noach. A ben Noach can be killed on an ed echad, can be killed without hatra'ah, and can be killed with a beit din of one. So his din changed. But on the other hand, mitato lo ishtane, he's still subject to the same death penalty. And that is because by rotzeach, a person who kills is subject to a punishment by Saif. And that's also the standard punishment for a ben Noach. So his punishment is still Saif, and that's not enough of a change for him to be classified as a new individual. So when it says, Vishlam arotzeach mi kara Saif, fashta Saif, your explanation works well when he's speaking about the killing aspect over there, because before he was chayav mita with Saif, and now he's chayav mita with Saif. El eshenish mi kara Saif, fashta chenek. Then by Eshet Ish, while he was a goy, he'd be subject to the penalty of Saif. Now that he converts, he'll be subject to the penalty of Chenek. Binara amurasa. What we're speaking about here is not a simple extramarital affair. It's a case where he had relationship or consorted with a Nara amurasa. So it's a Jewish woman who was a Nara amurasa because there's no such thing as a Nara amurasa by Goyim that we already established. Therefore, the Ben Noach is punished for violating arayot of the Jews with the Jews' punishment. And we saw that earlier. Therefore, over here, where he consorted with an ara murasa, he'd be subject to the death penalty by skila. That would be true when he's a Ben Noach. And if he converted, that'd still be the truth. And therefore, the Yidim Skila, both of them are subject to the punishment of Skila. And now you've made it where there's no distinction in the Mitah. So even though the Din has changed, the Mitah hasn't changed, that's not enough to be considered a new entity. Va'asakein b'Yisrael dumya de'eshet chaver oktani. Wait a minute, doesn't it say here, he perpetrated the crime in two ways. One way he did it to his fellow Ben Noach, that's the first series in the Braita. The second series in the Braita is where he does it to a Jew, meaning that he kills a Jew, or he has a relationship with a Jewish woman who's married. Mar says, well, if that's the case, when it says, Asakein b'Yisrael dumya de'eshet chaver oktani, similar to Eshet Chavero. Meaning that the parallel in the Mishnah is that by the Goy, he slept with his fellow Ben Noach's wife, the only Ishut that we find by Ben Noach is Bulat Baal, is that they're fully fledged married with the consummation of the marriage. So if that's the case, if you bring that parallel over to the case of Israel, we're not talking about a Nara Murasa, we're speaking about a fully married woman. Ella, the answer here is, Kala B'chamura Mishach Shaicha. When you have a lighter form of punishment, it is subsumed in the greater form of punishment. So over here, where he was subject to Saif when he was a Ben Noach, and then he converts and he would get Chenek as a Jew, Chenek is subsumed in Saif. Saif's a higher form of death penalty, so it's subsumed in Saif. It's both Saif and Chenek because Chenek is below it. For that reason, there's no change in his death penalty. There might be a change in his din, but there's no change in the death penalty, even though there really is a change in the death penalty. He's going from Saif to Chenek. Nevertheless, Chenek is subsumed within Saif. And where it says, Anichal Rabbanan Damrei Saif Chamor. That works well if you say Saif sits above Chenek. Ella the Rabbi Shimon Damar Chenek Chamor, who says that Chenek is more stringent than Saif. It sits above Saif. Ma'ika the Meimar. How are you going to explain this case by the Eshet Ish, where he remains culpable even after he converts? Shimon Sabalak Tanit Bei Rabbi Menashe. That's not a problem because he holds like Tanit Bei Menashe. They'll call Mita Amura LeBnei Noach Enu Elo Chenek. As opposed to the other view, which is the standard default death penalty for a guy is Saif. Over here we have the Tanit Bei Menashe who believe that the standard death penalty for the Ben Noach is Chenek. So if that's the case, now you don't have any change in the death penalty because according to that, when he's a Ben Noach, he was subject to Chenek. Now that he's Yisrael, he's also subject to Chenek, so there is no change in the Mitah. Bishlam HaEshidish, Mikara Chenek, Vashta Chenek. That works well now for the extramarital affair, because before he was subject to Chenek as a Ben Noach, and now he's subject to Chenek. El Rotzeach, Mikara Chenek, Vashta Saif. Problem is with a murderer now. You said that originally he would get Chenek, because that's the standard fare for a Ben Noach. On the other hand, now as a Jew, being a Rotzeach, you get Saif. Kala b'chamura mishach shaicha. Here now we can answer on behalf of Rabbi Shimon the same way that we answered on behalf of the Chachamim, which is that Chenek sits above Saif, and if subsumed in the punishment of Chenek is Saif. Therefore when he converts and he's going to get the punishment of Saif, that's okay because had he been a Goy, he would be subject to Chenek, and Chenek is higher than Saif and subsumes within it Saif. Lema misayile. Let us say that this is a proof to Rabbi Chanina. Sarcha v'achakach bagra. If the Nara Marasa sinned, and then afterwards she ages out of being a Nara Marasa. Tidon b'chenek. She gets the punishment of being an Eshet Ish and not of Nara Marasa. B'skila my time alone. Why doesn't she get the punishment of a Nara Marasa? La mishum d'ol b'ishtane ishtane. Because she aged out. And since she's now a new person or aged out, she's no longer subject to the penalty that we mentioned before. Because in Hocha, certainly over here, the Ishtane de Gamre, where it completely changed. There is only a case where Ishtane Mitata, that the Mita has changed, but the Din is still the same. Nevertheless, we say there that she now graduated out and doesn't get the death penalty. Certainly over here by the Ger, when he has a complete Shinoi, both the Shinoi of the Din and the Shinoi of the Mita, he's a new person. Then you certainly should over there say that he is Patur. Mar says, Hamarlei Rabbi Yochanan Latana Tana Tidon Biskila. Says, no. That brighter that you just brought as evidence of this, that's not really evidence. Because when it says, Sarcha V'achaga Bagra Tidon Bechenek, that brighter Rabbi Yochanan indicated to the individual was bringing that down, that he should amend it to read Tidon Biskila. That even though she aged out, but if the violation took place while she was a Nara Marasa, she would still be subject to the penalty of a Nara Marasa, which is Skila. So over here, even though her body changed and she aged out, nevertheless, her death penalty didn't change and she remains that way. Hachanami, so too in the case of Rabbi Chanina, we would say, then he should be subject to the death penalty, that of the lighter death penalty, which is the one that he was when he was a Ben Noach, but he can't be freed of the violation just because he converted. Now, the view of the Gemara, before we get to Rabbi Yochanan, who seems to indicate against Rabbi Chanina, nevertheless, the view of Rabbi Chanina is that when a person starts with a fresh slate, that's exactly what they get, a completely fresh slate. So there's certain times or changes in a person's life which move them from one category to the next. Conversion is one of those. From Ben Noach to a Jew, it's such a significant transition that the person on the other side has no connection to the person on the beginning. And similarly with age, as children get older and they age out, that age or that change in age makes it that they graduate out, move out of the previous category. And that would be the Havamina over there. Then in all those cases, they would not be subject to the death penalty. Okay, next Mishnah, Ben Sorer Moreh Nidon Al Shem Sofal. So this is what we already discussed back on Samachet Amud Bet. This is what we saw Rabbi Shimon objected to, which is that the Ben Sorer Moreh is not Nidon for what's happening now, rather what he will do in the future. Yamut Zakai Vayamut Chayav. Better off that he dies innocent rather than dying, falling victim to what we know is going to happen to him if he continues down this path. Shemitah Tan Shemitshayim Anadahem Vanadolam. The death of the Rishayim is good for them, and it's good for the world. It's good for them because they no longer can sin. It's good for the world because they're no longer around. The Tzadikim, the death of the Tzadikim is rather them, is bad for them because they can no longer perform mitzvot. Ve'ra'ala olam, and it's bad for the world because they're no longer there to defend or provide protection for the world because of their tzidkut. Sorry, yayim v'shein ala Rishayim. Wine and sleep for their shame. Another ham, another olam. It's good for them, and it's good for the world. It's good for them because as long as they're drinking and sleeping, they don't have the ability to sin. And so that protects them from sin. It's another olam because they're preoccupied with their drinking and sleeping that they don't have time to take issue with other things. The tzaddikim, on the other hand, drinking and sleeping for the tzaddikim, rather ham is bad for them because they no longer can perform mitzvot. And again, it's bad for the world because they can protect the world with their mitzvot and that which they are doing. Rashi goes over here, the reason that it's bad for the tzaddikim is because they won't be involved with Torah or mitzvot. And it says, it's bad for the world because the Torah that the chachamim or tzaddikim are engaged in protects the generation. When they stop learning, bad things happen in the world. So they contribute in that way in terms of their Torah providing protection and benefit to the world so that when they desist from Torah, it's negative for not only them, but also for the world as a whole. Pizur Rishayim, disbursement of the Rishayim, another ham is good for them, but another olam. Obviously it's good for the world because they can no longer take counsel of each other or plan together to do these evil things. Beneficial to them because they're less likely to get involved in these bad things or take advice to get into other difficulties. The tzaddikim, on the other hand, for the tzaddikim, them being dispersed is rather hand bad for them because they no longer have a chabura or individuals to work with them. Virada olam, and it's bad for the world because they won't be there to protect them. Kinus l'rishayim, the rishayim gather together, rather ham, it's bad for them because they're going to plot bad things. Virada olam, because now they're going to carry out even more evil acts. The tzaddikim, the gathering of tzaddikim is another ham, another olam, and it's good for them and good for the world because the tzaddikim come together, allows them to learn together, allows them to increase their doing of mitzvot. That's beneficial to them and beneficial to the world as a whole. Shega the rishayim, when things are tranquil and the world is at peace, when the rishayim are quiet and still, rather ham, rather olam, bad for them and bad for the world because the fact that they are bored or nothing's occupying them means that they will get preoccupied, and that's bad for us and bad for them. The tzaddikim, on the other hand, analahem v'analeolam. It's good for them and good for the world because it allows them to learn together, allows them to increase their doing of mitzvot, and that's beneficial to them and beneficial to the world as a whole. Okay, we're going to stop here at the Gemara at the end of Ayin Aleph Amud Bet.